I'm glad to see we have so many students who do not want to be lawyers who are in here. I'm going to start, you all know the topic of the class. It's about the corrupt origins of central banking in America. But I'm going to like to start with an explanation of why I do this kind of research, why I've written articles with titles like this. And I would recommend, if you get one article, this is one of my favorite Rothbard readings, is Anatomy of the State. It's online. It's an old essay. The Mises Institute also publishes it as a small little booklet, Anatomy of the State. And in this little booklet, Murray Rothbard puts together all of his learning and understanding about economics, politics, history, political philosophy, to explain from, the most famous libertarian intellectual of the 20th century what the state is all about. And so I think if you're here at Mises University, you really need to read this essay if you've never read that essay on the anatomy of the state. And one of the important points he makes in the state is that there's always been, for hundreds, probably thousands of years, a special relationship between intellectuals and the state, even before they were called intellectuals. And what is that relationship? Well, he asked, well, what's in it for the state to have a relationship with intellectuals? Well, the intellectuals are the ones who spread state propaganda and the obfuscation of the truth about what the state is really up to. And then he asked, well, what's in it for the intellectuals? Well, what's in it for them is money, power, position. In today's modern world, it always amazes me how some of the dumbest people I've ever run across have endowed chairs at Harvard, Stanford, Yale, and all these prestigious places. And Murray Rothbard spent most of his career at a small school in New York State before he went to UNLV. And of course, you all know that Ludwig von Mises could never get NYU to pay him a dime in salary. His salary was always paid for from private donors. And so that's the way the world works. A classic example of this phenomenon would be historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, who confessed to plagiarism several years ago. She wrote a book on the Kennedy family, and her whole career has been spent writing apologies and excuses for odious politicians. She wrote a book on Lyndon Johnson, the Kennedy family, and then she got caught plagiarizing, and she admitted that she paid a six-figure sum to the person, Lynn McTaggart, who she plagiarized. And so they kicked her off the Pulitzer Prize Committee. They kicked her off PBS. And she laid low for about 6 months. And then she got a gigantic contract to write a book on Lincoln, and Steven Spielberg made a movie out of it. And so if you're a court historian and an apologist for the state, you can get away with everything, even plagiarism. Anybody else would have been ruined, but she's a celebrity, a star. They invited to give her the keynote speech at the Gettysburg battlefield, at the anniversary of the battle on the 4th of July, and that sort of thing. And this is the sort of thing Murray Rothbard talks about in this book. And in one passage, he says a key ingredient of what the intellectuals are supposed to do is to confuse the public about what the state is up to obfuscate, to confuse. And they do this with scientific jargon in a lot of places. And he mentions Keynesianism or Keynesian economics. And so there's a long list of myths that are used to support the state. And the myths are all about the grandiosity, the generosity, the magnificence of the state, the necessity of the state, and at the same time, the evils of the civil society and private enterprise, greed, selfishness, and so forth. And these are all part of the economics profession. A lot of these myths have become a part of the standard fare in economics. And so that's why, for example, some of the research and writing I've done over the years, as I had an article I mentioned in my last lecture on the origins of antitrust. I published this many years ago in the early 80s. An article showing that all the business firms that were accused of monopolizing in the late 19th century were expanding production and cutting prices for 20 years faster than the economy as a whole was. So it was a myth that there was rampant monopolization and therefore that there was a justification for the Sherman Antitrust Act. Another of my articles I looked at the origins of public utility regulation. The standard story is that, again, there was rampant monopoly occurring in electric power, natural gas, industries like that. In my article, The Myth of Natural Monopoly, I dug up the actual facts and showed that, no, that never happened. It never happened that way. Economic theorists theorized that this could possibly, conceivably, maybe happen that way, but there's no evidence that it ever did. And so this topic, the corrupt origins of central banking, is along those lines of this type of research, of looking into the origins of these status myths about central banking. And there are many myths about the necessity, many reasons have been given about the necessity of a bank run by politicians in secret out of the nation's capital. Now, there's a good idea for you, isn't it? And this was an idea that was breached at the very beginning of the American Republic. And, of course, there was never unanimous opinion that this would be a good idea. At the beginning of the American Republic, there were many, many critics. There's a long tradition of sound money among American economists from north, south, all over the country, who opposed this whole idea of having a national bank run by politicians. And so this topic is sort of in line with my other research of looking into the origins of these status myths, most of which have been just accepted at face value by just about everyone, especially economists. And so does anybody happen to know the name of the first national bank, the very first bank that that was ever existed in America that was sort of a precursor of the Fed, but it was the first national bank run by politicians? Anybody? Nobody? Okay, the actual the name of it was the Bank of North America. There was another, the second one was called Bank of the United States, but the Bank of the North America was the very first one, and it came along in the year 1781. And so, Murray Rothbard has written in tremendous detail about the origins of the Fed in his several of his books, including A History of Money and Banking in the United States, which is a really great book. It's one of my favorite books that Rothbard wrote. Much more can be done, I think, and I have done a little bit more on really the roots of central banking. We go back way further than the Fed. The Fed was 1913. And so the very first bank run by politicians was the idea of one of the wealthiest men in America, and his name was Robert Morris. He's called by some historians as the financier of the American Revolution because he supposedly lent a lot of money to the U.S., to the government, to finance arm purchases for the revolution. But Rothbard called him, he was just another defense contractor, and he made a lot of money. It wasn't as though he was some philanthropist who gave up all, who donated money for the cause. He made a lot of money by being a defense contractor. But he was a part of the nationalist tradition in America, which plagues Americans to this day, the nationalist tradition. And the nationalist tradition always wanted a highly centralized government run by a de facto king who would not be called a king, he'd be called president, but essentially a king. They wanted a permanent president, and they also wanted all political power at the center, at the national capital, and the essential abolition of federalism or states' rights. They were opposed to having the people of the states having much of a say at all over their national government. And coupled with that, they wanted to introduce into America the British mercantilist system, an American version of the British mercantilist system of corporate welfare, protectionist tariffs, and a central bank run by politicians that would provide cheap credit to politically connected businesses. This was the exact system that the colonists had fought a long and bloody revolution against. So you can imagine that this is the reason why the Jeffersonians, the opponents of these people, were such fierce opponents of this. They had just fought a revolution, an 8-year-long revolution, to get away from this system. And here comes the Federalists, led by such people as Alexander Hamilton and Robert Morris, the businessman, saying, well, let's bring this very system to America. To give you an idea, at the Constitutional Convention, Hamilton was the intellectual leader of the nationalists, and his proposal was for a permanent president who would appoint all the governors, who would have veto power over all state legislation. So it would essentially be a king. And then they wanted to use that so that no state, the citizens of any of the states could oppose the imposition of protectionist tariffs nationwide, the use of tax dollars for corporations to build roads and canals and other things, and the dispensation of cheap subsidized credit to politically favored businesses. That was the plan. And so, and there's nothing mysterious about this in terms of, there's nothing ironical or illogical. Their basic idea was, if you're on the paying side of a mercantilist empire, that's a bad thing. It might even be worth fighting a revolution to get rid of it. But if you're on the collecting side, it's a good thing. As Mel Brooks said when he played the King of France in A History of the World Part 2, it's good to be the king. So if you're the king collecting all the loot from the mercantilist empire, you know, it's a good deal. It's a good gig. And that's what they wanted. Here's what how Rothbard explains it. He said, Morris and his compatriots wanted this, quote, to reimpose in the new United States a system of mercantilism and big government similar to that in Great Britain, against which the colonists had rebelled. The object was to have a strong central government, particularly a strong president or king as chief executive, built up by high taxes and heavy public debt. The strong government was to impose high tariffs to subsidize domestic manufacturers, develop a big navy to open up and subsidize foreign markets for American exports, and launch a massive system of internal public works. In short, the United States was to have a British system without Great Britain. Murray Rothbard wrote that in his book, The Mystery of Banking. Okay, and so and he went on to say that an important part of the Morris scheme, Rothbard called it the Morris scheme, was, quote, to organize and head a central bank to provide cheap credit and expanded money for himself and his allies. The Bank of North America was deliberately modeled after the Bank of England. And so they did succeed in that. They did succeed in getting that put into place. And then the Bank of North America only lasted for 1 year. And here's what happened. It was given a monopoly privilege of notes receivable in all tax payments to state governments and the federal government. No other banks were permitted to operate in the country. You know, even I could make money in a business like that, where it's illegal for people to compete. It reminds me of Leland Stanford, the founder of Stanford University. He used his political connections as a senator, former senator and governor, to make it illegal for any railroads to compete within the state of California with his railroad. And so, you know, even I could make money in a gig like that, and, you know, an academic. And so but the Bank of North America was such a failure, and people had such low confidence in its currency that it was privatized after 1 year. So that was the first attempt. But they never gave up. They finally did succeed with the Fed, you know, many years later. And Rothbard talks about what he calls Morris's youthful disciple, Alexander Hamilton. And this is an interesting story of Hamilton's role in getting resurrecting a national bank. In that at the end of the American Revolution, Hamilton, he knew nothing about finance and economics. And but he was a clever political mover and shaker. You know, how else could a young man in his early 20s become George Washington's aide-de-camp and protege? And so he must have been one major league ass kisser, don't you think, to be in a position like that. And he was, everyone says he was also extremely brilliant. That by the way, is why Jefferson hated him so much. He thought he had evil intentions and that his program would destroy liberty, and he was brilliant. And so that's a very dangerous combination of talents there. And so his youthful disciple, so the story is, and this comes from Ron Chernow's Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Hamilton, that he knew nothing about finance, but he knew he wanted to be a wealthy man after the revolution and use his political connections with George Washington of all people. And he knew Robert Morris was the richest man in America. And so he booked up on finance. He asked Senator Timothy Pickering, who was also at the time, he was also one of Washington's generals, who was known to know a lot about finance. What can I read to sort of book up sort of cliff notes on finance? And so here's what Chernow says. Hamilton brushed up on money matters and had Colonel Timothy Pickering send him some primers, David Hume's Political Discourses, tracts written by the English clergyman and polemicist Richard Price, and his all-purpose crib, Postlethwaite's Universal Dictionary of Trade and Commerce. So he learned what he knew about trade and commerce from a dictionary. Hamilton sent a marathon letter to Morris that set forth a full-fledged system for shoring up American credit and creating a national bank. And so he knew next to nothing, but then after reading this dictionary, he apparently knew enough to write a 30-page letter. And I've read this letter. It's online if you want to search for this. Alexander Hamilton's letter to Robert Morris, you can find it easily online. Even some of you with your computers out, you can get it right now. And so, he didn't really need this dictionary. Basically, what he said, "Dear Mr. Morris, I hear that you are in favor of protectionist tariffs, a bank run by politicians that will give you cheap credit, and corporate welfare. I agree." And that's pretty much what it said. And so in the letter, he advocated protectionist tariffs, a central bank, taxes on land, poll taxes, and a large public debt. And so anyway, Robert Morris is why Hamilton got appointed as the first Treasury Secretary. George Washington gets a letter from the richest man in the country, the financier of the Revolution, saying we would like Hamilton to be Treasury Secretary. And then Trino also writes that George Washington then turned to Alexander Hamilton and said, "I didn't know you knew anything about this. We never talked about finance." And that's very different, isn't it, from the story that you may have heard about Alexander Hamilton and his genius. There's one biography of Hamilton by William Graham Sumner, the great late 19th century Yale University libertarian sociologist, that pretty much says that Hamilton was a dunce on economics. But if you read the history books, what they'll tell you is he was some kind of a genius who thought that government debt was wealth. And so the more debt we had, the wealthier we would be, is sort of what he was saying. And that Jefferson is supposed to be the ignoramus on economics, you know, his nemesis. But, you know, if you walked into Jefferson's home tomorrow, Monticello, you'd see a marble bust of Turgot right by the front door. And Turgot was the French finance minister. And Jefferson translated from French into English the writings of Turgot and the other French physiocrats. And Turgot's name is up here somewhere as a precursor of the Austrian school. So it was Jefferson who had read Adam Smith and the physiocrats and all the economists of his day. And it was Hamilton who only read a dictionary on commerce and sort of propaganda pamphlets by British mercantilists. That's what he knew about economics. And this book by William Graham Sumner lays this all out. But anyway, they never gave up on resurrecting the national bank and their agenda. So Hamilton, when he was Treasury Secretary, I have to tell you the short story about his role at the Constitutional Convention before we get into how we got the first central bank, the first bank of the United States. And Hamilton walks into the Constitutional Convention. His plan was laid out as a permanent president who would appoint all the governors and have veto power over all the states. We didn't adopt that, of course, and they did discuss a national bank and rejected it at the convention. So Hamilton walks out, and he condemns the Constitution as a frail and worthless fabric. And so he spent the next several years lobbying for to subvert the Constitution in a lot of ways that I'm going to talk about in a minute. But as Treasury Secretary, he was very good at using patronage politics to try to solidify political support in Congress for the nationalist agenda of high protectionist tariffs, corporate welfare, and a central bank. And here's what one of the editors of the Federalist Papers said about this, Douglas Adair, one of the editors of the famous Federalist Papers. He said this: "With devious brilliance, Hamilton set out by a program of class legislation to unite the propertied interests of the Eastern Seaboard into a cohesive administration party that would support the administration, while at the same time he attempted to make the executive dominant over the Congress by a lavish use of the spoils system. In carrying out this scheme, Hamilton transformed every financial transaction of the Treasury Department into an orgy of speculation and graft in which selected senators, congressmen, and certain of their richer constituents throughout the nation participated," end quote. Now, that's not me or Walter Block or Murray Rothbard writing that. That was the editor of the Federalist Papers, Douglas Adair. Sort of the 1980 edition of the Federalist Papers. And Adair is a pretty well-known historian. And so that was the game. The game was to use patronage to get this through, all these programs through that were not really constitutional. But here, and one of Hamilton's big successes is that he nationalized the state debt, the state government debt that was accumulated to finance the Revolutionary War, nationalized it, and the insiders, the political insiders, understood that the debt would be cashed out at face value at some point. The old debt was to be cashed out at face value. And here's what John Steele Gordon, the business historian John Steele Gordon, he wrote about this in his book. He has a book called Hamilton's Blessing, and which is what gave me the idea for my book, Hamilton's Curse. But anyway, he said, this plan immediately became public knowledge in New York City, said Gordon, but news of it spread only slowly via horseback and sailing vessel to the rest of the country. So since we have all these young students in here, this was before the internet. So the word didn't travel to, and New York, why New York City? Well, that was the capital at the time. Washington, D.C. wasn't the capital at the time. So the political insiders in the nation's capital knew this, but the word didn't spread to Virginia, North Carolina, you know, the hinterlands for quite some time. So there was a major arbitrage opportunity that was created here because the insiders knew that there's all this outstanding debt out there, all these old war bonds. A lot of the revolutionary soldiers had been paid with war bonds that at the time were trading between 2 and 10% of par value. And so here's how the historian Claude Bowers, sort of the 1930s era historian, Claude Bowers, B-O-W-E-R-S, he wrote a book, famous biography called Hamilton and Jefferson. He said, here's what happened. Expresses with very large sums of money were on their way to North Carolina for a purpose of speculation and certificates, and they splashed and bumped over the wretched winter roads two fast-sailing vessels chartered by a member of Congress who had been an officer in the war were plowing the waters southward on a similar mission. So there was a mad dash by the insiders, the political insiders, by sea, by land. They didn't have airplanes back then either, folks, so that it wouldn't be by air. But to buy up as much of this old war debt at between 2 and 10% of the value, face value, as they could, because they knew they could bring it back to Washington, and then a certain date, maybe in 2 months later, they could get this, you know, say $100 worth of bonds and sell it for $1,000 and become very wealthy. And this is exactly what happened. And here's something else that Bowers writes, that he says, New York newspapers speculated that Hamilton's political benefactor, Robert Morris, made at least $18 million in the deal. Not a bad day's work. Governor George Clinton of New York made $5 million, and Hamilton himself purchased some of the bonds. It's kind of entertaining when I read all these biographies of famous figures by the so-called mainstream historians. They always make such phony excuses for their heroes. With Hamilton, with Ron Chernow's book where he writes about this on Hamilton, he said he bought these, yeah, he did arrange to have these bonds purchased, but they were for his brother-in-law. And then another instance, he said Hamilton did once purchase 6 slaves at a slave auction, but they were for his brother-in-law. As though that makes it right. He bought slaves for somebody else. He gave them away. What a nice guy. And so when you read, when you get into this literature, it's like theater of the absurd when you read some of these excuses. And so old Thomas Jefferson sniffed out what was going on here. He figured the system out. So keep in mind, Hamilton and his party have been famous for massive patronage. They use the whole government for patronage to buy political power. Okay, and so Jefferson was convinced that they were creating a system of organized corruption. And so he wrote a letter. This is a letter that he wrote years later, many years later. This was February 4th, 1818, an essay written by Thomas Jefferson. Hamilton died in 1804 in the famous duel with Aaron Burr. And our friend Gary North once actually started a Aaron Burr Society, and they had ball caps that said, "Not soon enough," on the ball cap. He didn't like Hamilton much either. And so here's what Jefferson said. He said, Hamilton's financial system had two objects. First, as a puzzle to exclude popular understanding and inquiry. Secondly, as a machine for the corruption of the legislature. And so his financial system, meaning a national bank run by politicians, first, make it as confusing as possible so that not even members of Congress could understand it. Remember what I said at the very beginning about Rothbard's essay on Anatomy of the State, that one of the points he makes is that the role of intellectuals for the state is to use scientific-sounding language to obfuscate what the state is really up to. And this is what Jefferson is saying. And second, as a machine for the corruption of the legislature, what does he mean by that? What corruption? How can a central bank, a national bank, cause corruption of the legislature? Here's what he went on to say. He said that Hamilton, this is Jefferson describing Hamilton. He said he avowed the opinion that man could be governed by only one of two motives only, force of interest, okay, but force, he observed, in this country was out of the question. And the interest, therefore, of the members of Congress must be laid hold of to keep the legislature in unison with the executive. And with grief and shame, it must be acknowledged that his machine was not without effect. That even in this, the birth of our government, some members were found sordid enough to bend their duty to their interests and to look after personal rather than public good. Jefferson was referring to the mad rush to buy up the war debt from all these veterans, war veterans, and other people who owned it, and then cash in at the higher price. And so, and Jefferson goes on to say, men thus enriched by the dexterity of a leader, Hamilton, would follow, of course, the chief who was leading them to fortune and thus become the zealous instruments of all his political enterprises. But there's a problem. There's a conundrum here. These guys are going to die off or retire. And so to have a permanent political power base, you need something more permanent. You know, the arbitrage deal, because of the nationalization of the state debt, that was a one-time deal. Yeah, they made a lot of money, they bought a lot of support, and these men will follow the Federalists, but that's over. And a lot of these people were maybe voted out of office, they died, they retired, and there goes your votes. There goes your votes for protectionist tariffs and so forth, and the whole nationalist agenda, okay? And so here's what Jefferson goes on to say. He said, quote, some engine of influence more permanent must be contrived. This engine was the Bank of the United States. And so he looked at the Bank of the United States as being something that would be a permanent engine of corruption. The Bank of the United States, he thought, would not go away. Once they had this thing in there that would corrupt politics, it would be there forever. You know, just like the Department of Homeland Security, everyone in this room will be long dead, and the Department of Homeland Security will still be there. You know, they never get rid of these things. And so that was Jefferson's view. And he goes on. You know, there's more letters from Jefferson discussing this. And Jefferson talks about a dinner conversation he had with, this would have been fun to be a fly on the wall at this dinner. It's Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, Secretary of War Henry Knox, John Adams, the former president, and the U.S. Attorney General Edmund Randolph. And Jefferson writes in this letter, for the truth of which I attest the God who made me. So he's saying, honest to God, this is a true story. And they were at dinner, and the dinner conversation went this way. John Adams said that if it weren't for the corruption, the British Constitution would be the best configuration of government in the world. Hamilton interjects and said, oh no, it's because of the corruption that the British system is the best in the world. Because it's the corruption that keeps expanding the state far beyond what, say, an American constitution would do. You know, don't forget, Hamilton denounced the American constitution as a frail and worthless fabric because it limited government too much. He wanted government to be much bigger than it already was. And so Jefferson writes that Hamilton was, quote, so bewitched and perverted by the British example as to be under thorough conviction that corruption was essential to the government of a nation. Okay, and so that's how Thomas Jefferson smoked out what he thought was the real purpose of this first Bank of the United States, and we did get this bank, the first Bank of the United States, after a debate between the two of them. George Washington asked Hamilton and Jefferson to write up the case for and against the constitutionality of the Bank of the United States. And this is where Hamilton invented the idea of implied powers of the Constitution. Jefferson came back and essentially said, Hamilton said, yeah, you need to read between the lines, there are implied powers of the Constitution. Jefferson comes back and essentially says, I have read between the lines and there's blank space between the lines. You know, he didn't literally say that, but that, I think that's the gist of what his argument was. But what Hamilton's argument hinged on there is there is a necessary and proper clause of the Constitution. It gives the government the power to do everything necessary and proper to carry out the delegated powers, the constitutional powers. And so Hamilton said, it's necessary to have a bank run by politicians as a depository of tax revenues. Jefferson came back and said, we have banks. We don't need a bank run by politicians to deposit the tax revenues. You could deposit some in this bank, some in that bank. We have banks. And so, but in the end, what happened was we got the second national bank after the Bank of North America because George Washington cut a deal with the Federalists. They were about to move planning on moving the national capital to Virginia by creating Washington, D.C., and they did. And George Washington said, but I want the national capital to abut my property in Virginia, Mount Vernon. If you do that, if you expand the border of the national capital, I will sign the law that puts into place the Bank of the United States. And so they did. So they did run the national capital all the way down to right near George Washington's property, which greatly increased his land value, and he signed off on it. And so the original Bank of the United States got a 20-year charter, and it proceeded to create a tremendous depression, boom and bust style depression. Rothbard's History of Money and Banking in the United States, he points out that it also created 72% inflation, price inflation, in the first 5 years that it created. And it also corrupted politics, just as the Jeffersonians predicted, by financing the political campaigns of favored politicians, and of course, only favored politicians. And so the Congress did not bring it back after its 20-year charter. It was allowed to die off after the 20-year charter. And then what happened after that is that the War of 1812 ran up a lot of war debt, and so the Bank of the United States was resurrected in January of 1817 to help monetize the war debt. And so 1817. Anybody know the title of Murray Rothbard's doctoral dissertation? The Panic of 1819. And so I don't think the two things are unrelated, that the National Bank was resurrected, and it did inflate the currency a great deal to help monetize the debt from the War of 1812, and it created another boom and bust. And so we had the Panic of 1819, and Rothbard calls it, you know, the first really large-scale unemployment in the United States. I think he cites a statistic, if I can remember it reasonably correctly, I think he said they went in Philadelphia. I think he said they went from 9,500 people employed to 2,500 people employed, something like in manufacturing, which wasn't automobile plants, but you know, small craftsmen manufacturing things. And so there was, you know, really some serious unemployment created by the first big panic. And by the way, until the 1920s. Panics were called panics. You know, the word depression was invented by Herbert Hoover, the official designation of an economic downturn as a depression, because Hoover thought panic was too extreme. He thought depression would be a better word for this sort of thing. Let's call it something else. Call it depression. And so the bank was resurrected. It immediately created the Great Depression of 1819. And then by the time you get into the 1920s, it had been also corrupting politics. Henry Clay stepped down from the president's cabinet in, I think it was 1823, I think it was the year, because he had run up $40,000 in gambling debt, and he needed to make up some money. This was back in the days where you could go to debtor's prison. Maybe not if you're part of the political elite of the country, but they still had debtors' prisons. And so he became the general counsel of the Bank of the United States, Henry Clay. They paid him a big salary. They paid him in land and in money. And he was paid on a per-case basis. And so in one of Clay's biographers, Maurice Baxter, he says, after 2 years, Henry Clay was very pleased with his compensation. And he was able to go back into the government. He was very pleased. So he made... you know, this is the 1820s, and he made maybe $50,000 or $60,000 in 2 years, and so he became, he made a bundle by doing this, and he was, of course, was a strong supporter. In one of my books, I also quote Daniel Webster as writing a letter to the president of the Bank of the United States, Nicholas Biddle, threatening letter saying, if you want my support, that is my vote in the Senate, you will give me my retainer. So they were literally, the Bank of the United States was literally buying votes with cash from members of Congress. And they were also, they also did such things as finance the political campaigns of the proponents of the bank, so that they would be able to defeat the opponents of the bank. And the biggest opponent was Andrew Jackson, the President Andrew Jackson. And so there was a big fight over this, because the bank had done what Jefferson warned it would do. It would corrupt politics. And you see, the argument I'm making is that was always the intent of a central bank from the very beginning. That's a big part of the intent. Despite all the rhetoric about economic stability and economic planning and prosperity, corrupting politics was always the intent. It's not just the effect. It was always the intent. It was designed as an institution to do this. And the first several examples of national banking proved it long before the Fed came into being. And so in Jackson's day, people of the states, the various states, hated this bank because it would come into their state and would corrupt their state politics. It would create, you know, sort of mini boom and bust cycles on a regional basis. And so in the state of Ohio, the Bank of the United States opened up two branches, and the state of Ohio imposed a $50,000 tax per year per branch. And this is the 1820s. And so that's that amount of money will jingle in your pocket if you put it in today's dollars. And so and the Bank of the United States refused to pay. So the state of Ohio sent armed marshals carrying a big chest into the Bank of the United States building, and they went right into the vaults and took $100,000 and walked out with it. So it was like a legal bank robbery by the cops. You know, the cops walk into the bank with guns, you know, and they take the money and they walk out. And of course, this led to litigation and so forth. The state of Maryland did something similar. So there are many states that helped Andrew Jackson try to destroy this corrupting bank. And that ended up in, there was a famous Supreme Court case called McCulloch versus Maryland over this, where Chief Justice John Marshall, who was a protege of Hamilton's, and a devotee of his ideas, he was a fellow nationalist. You may have heard this famous slogan that came from his decision that said, "The power to tax is the power to destroy." You may have heard that. Well, he was referring to the power of the state of Ohio to tax the Bank of the United States is the power to destroy the Bank of the United States. And the people in Ohio were saying, "Well, yeah, that's the idea. Yeah, that's yeah, you got it. That's right." And this is one of the instances where Andrew Jackson, his response as president, was essentially to say to Mr. Marshall, thank you for your opinion, but my opinion is different, and we have three branches of government, not one. And so, you know, he sort of, you know, give him the raspberries. I don't know if he literally gave him the raspberries or gave him the middle finger or something like that, but he's that's pretty much what he did. So, you know, so what? The Bank of the United States is constitutional. And so Jackson went ahead and vetoed the recharter, and the Bank of the United States disappeared. It eventually was defunded. The money, the tax dollars that were deposited there over several years were taken out. And so the origins of central banking in America involve the inherent corruption, which was always the idea. It was Hamilton's idea. And then it was followed through by Henry Clay, picked up the mantle of this. And then after he died in 1852, and then Abraham Lincoln picked up the mantle of national banking, of a national bank. There's the big fat book on the history of the American Whig Party by University of Virginia historian named Michael Holt. I read books like this at the beach. You know, I go to the beach and I have these big fat books, history of the American Whig Party. One, probably the most ridiculous one I've ever read at the beach was The Hard Hand of War. It's about war, a history of war crimes. So it's everybody else has People magazine or trashy novels. I'm reading the history of war crimes on the beach. But anyway, he says in his big fat history of the American Whig Party that no one was a more vociferous proponent of bringing back a national bank in the Whig Party than Abraham Lincoln was. And, you know, as a state member of the state legislature in his political career before becoming president. He was a Whig, and the Whigs, that was their, they were the new nationalists at the time. And so, but they didn't succeed until the Lincoln administration brought back the National Currency Acts and the Legal Tender Acts. So they did nationalize the money supply. They did go in a big direction toward nationalizing the money supply, but they did not bring back a new bank. That took, the Fed would come many years later. And as a sort of a interesting story about this, when I first started doing this sort of economic history research on such topics, I was invited to be a discussant on a panel in Washington, D.C. at a conference, an economic conference. And the speakers were Richard Vedder and Lowell Galloway. And some of you probably know the work of Vedder and Galloway. They wrote a great book called Out of Work, A History of Unemployment in America. And they had written a paper on the growth of government and how the growth of government affects the economy over history. And they, and I was the discussant. And this was supposed to be some sort of panel or tribute to Art Laffer of Laffer Curve fame, this old little conference. And Art Laffer was there, and Jack Kemp was there, the congressman, Jack Kemp, sitting there. And so I'm the discussant. They present their paper, and they said that just their conclusion is a big, long econometric thing with all these statistics and econometrics. And their conclusion was that, well, the growth of government didn't really seriously hinder the growth of the private economy until about the 1960s. Before that, it didn't have that much of an effect, they said. And my point as a discussant, I said, I think you need to go back further, maybe about another 100 years in your data, because I think the growth of government during and after the Civil War with the National Currency Acts, the First Income Tax, the Legal Tender Acts, the Internal Revenue Bureaucracy was created. That surely that fueled the growth of government. And maybe you're not catching this in your data that only goes back to 1900 or something like that. And that's all I said. Jack Kemp starts fuming and shuffling his chair and waving his arms and hissing. He started hissing like a snake. And then he abruptly pulls his chair back and storms out of the room. And a friend of mine that was sitting out in the hall out there told me that he came out there and he said, this guy out there is criticizing my hero. What the hell is he talking about? He thought I was like trashing Abe Lincoln. And I didn't even use the word Lincoln. I just said the National Currency Acts, the income tax. And that was my first inclination of how some people are just kind of insane about Abe Lincoln. It's just, you can't even, you know, can't even state a plain historical fact, and they just go all to pieces. They fall apart. And especially anyway, and Jack Kemp was like that. It was one of the weirdest things. And I remember I wrote it up. I wrote it up for the Free Market at the time. I remember Jeff Tucker heard about this, and he said, "You have to write this up in the Free Market." So the story is there somewhere in the Free Market archives on Mises.org. This was quite a long time ago there. And so we ended up getting getting this, the resurrection of nationalized money, but not a bank. And then I guess the final thing, when you look at what happened after that, in the years after, after the Civil War, as far as banking, the type of banking system that the United States had, is there's a book edited by Claudia Golden, who's a pretty well-known economic historian. She's a University of Chicago-trained historian. And she published an essay in this book that included Anna Schwartz as one of the authors. And Anna Schwartz was Milton Friedman's co-author in his famous History of Money in the United States. And this paper evaluated the American monetary system from the end of the Civil War to the turn of the 20th century. And they said it was plagued by, four stock market crashes, frequent boom and busts, and was generally a pretty bad system, very unstable system. Now, compared to that, there's a big, long treatise on the history of money and banking by Richard Timberlake. There aren't too many of them out there. There's one, there's Murray Rothbard, there's Richard Timberlake, and there's Friedman and Schwartz. And so there aren't too many big treatises on the history of money and banking that have been written. And there's the one by Timberlake and also the writings of Jeffrey Hummel, who has written some really good things on his from an economic historian's perspective on money and banking, said that this period from roughly the early 1840s to the early 1860s, even though it wasn't perfect, was probably the most stable monetary system America has ever had. It was called the Independent Treasury System. That was the name of the system. But we did not have a central bank, and the currency wasn't nationalized. There were competing currencies issued by state-chartered banks, and so we had competition in currency. And so, yes, it wasn't perfect. There's no perfection on earth. We've never had heaven on earth. And there were banks that went bankrupt, but far fewer than the other systems. Certainly, it was more stable than the system that replaced it in the late 19th century. And to give you an idea of how we had competing currencies, the word Dixie, there's a song, wish I was down in Dixie, you're in Dixie right now, referred to the South as Dixie. That was named after a currency named the Dix, D-I-X, from a New Orleans bank. It means 10 in French. And the Dix was such a stable currency that it was even used in Minnesota because it was backed by gold. And people had such great confidence in it that it was very widely used. And so there were competing currencies during this time. And that moderated the boom and bust cycle of monetary expansion, because any one bank that inflated its currency would ruin itself. It would shoot itself in the foot. People would fairly quickly catch on that the currency was being devalued compared to other currencies, so you don't want to use that. They run on the bank goes bankrupt. And that sort of thing did happen, but you can see the incentive that system created was to moderate that. And so maybe I'll quit there and see if we have any questions from the audience. But the main point I wanted to make was that when you see such things as bailouts by Ben Bernanke of all the establishment's buddies on Wall Street, and you say, oh my God, how corrupt can that be? When you see the Treasury Secretary under President Bush go to the Treasury Department, give Goldman Sachs, what was it, $2 billion, and then leave the Treasury Department, go back to Goldman Sachs, and then I read an article myself in the New York Times about his wife going out and buying a new $5 million house in the Hamptons. And you think, well, isn't that corrupt? My point is, that was always the purpose. That was always the purpose of the central bank, whether it's called the Bank of North America, the Bank of the United States, or the Federal Reserve Board. It was always the purpose. And it still is. And so I guess I'll quit right there see if you have any questions or comments. Led to what there?
Failure.
Failure.
Collapse of monarchies there.
Yeah.
And in Europe and Russia and so on. And that's why socialist economies came to the power. What do you think about?
Hans Hoppe, in his book, Democracy, the God That Failed, he says in the first chapter, I am not a monarchist. He says that. All it is he lays out what he thinks is an analysis of decision-making under the two types of political system, but he does not say that I advocate monarchy. And so he's been unfairly criticized as being a monarchist. But he says several times in chapter one, I'm not a monarchist, I don't advocate monarchy. And so, how much more plain can you get? That doesn't mean Hamilton was a hero. He was still a scoundrel as far as that goes, because he wanted to greatly expand the whole system that John C. Calhoun, another book I'll throw out is A Disquisition on Government by John C. Calhoun. It's an exposition of what is known as libertarian class theory. It's different than Marxian class theory, because Marxian class theory is, the capitalist class versus the labor class, the conflict. Whereas the libertarian class theory is you've got the net taxpayers, people who pay more in taxes than they get back from government, versus the net tax consumers, who are people who get more from government than they pay in taxes. And Calhoun predicted that the net tax consumers will inevitably overpower and overwhelm the net tax payers. And that's the type of system that Hamilton wanted to tremendously expand. And he also was an imperialist. He wanted to start another war with France. He lusted after what he called imperial glory. And so he wanted America to be an empire that would rival the British Empire and the Spanish Empire. And so I still consider him to be a scoundrel. My friend Butler Schaefer told me once that he was in New York City, and right 100 yards from the 9/11 site is Hamilton's grave. The old church that's next to the 9/11 site is Alexander Hamilton is buried there. And Butler told me, I made sure I stood there for a good 5 minutes to make sure there was no movement before I left. And then, so there was no movement, and he left. But another friend, Clyde Wilson, once told me that he was there, and he visited Hamilton's grave, and there were flowers on it. He said some of the people on Wall Street would make sure there were flowers on his grave all the time, because, after all, they owed it all to him. And so so the first part, I don't think he was a good guy, despite he was a monarchist. And I don't know. I haven't read Kinsella's latest theorizing. He spends a lot of time on the web, so I don't know. Does he have a job? I don't know. He spends so much. I think he's a retired lawyer now. He's always on the web, always, constantly, everywhere. And so I don't know. I think as far as the effect on Europe, I think it's much more complicated than that. I think what happened in Europe was, I would recommend a book by my old friend Jim Powell called Bully Boy. It's about Teddy Roosevelt, and another one on Wilson's War, especially Wilson's War, about how Woodrow Wilson got Americans into the World War I to remake Europe in our image, essentially. And I think that was the real disaster. I think Hoppe would probably agree with that also. But that didn't come from any Jeffersonian position. By then, the Jeffersonians were long out of power. The last Jeffersonian to run to be president was Grover Cleveland in the 1880s. But then they were all gone, and people like Woodrow Wilson just sneered at the Jeffersonians and sneered at the constitutionalists, the idea of limited government. They sneered at it. The progressives hated Jefferson and all that he stood for. And these are the people that interfered with Europe. And I would also add in response to that one of the downsides of the fact that America was the only country in the world in the 19th century to associate war with the ending of slavery was that since the secession movement did not succeed, the whole impetus of history was consolidation of government, centralization and consolidation. But had America ended slavery peacefully like everyone else did and then split up into two countries, that would have provided an alternative model to the world, to Germany and Russia and all these super centralized states that came in the 20th century, that federalism can still work. And so as far as the effect of the American government on Europe, I think that was the really bad thing. And the famous Lord Acton, the libertarian British historian, he actually wrote a letter to Robert E. Lee, the general, in 1866 after the war, where he said that he was, as I could paraphrase him, he says he was depressed over the effects at Appomattox, rejoicing over the defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo, because he thought the whole idea of secession was the only remaining check on the sovereign power. And I consider it kind of a disaster that America did not do what all the other countries of the world did and end slavery peacefully, like they all did. And because it ended up in, look where we are. It ended up, I think that has a lot to do with where we are. So another question in the back there. Well, the Charles Beard's thesis, for those of you who are not familiar with that, is a famous book by the early 20th century historian Charles Beard, that the Constitution was written by politicians who wanted to protect their property from confiscation by the masses, essentially, and to do other things that would allow them to profit from this government that they were creating. I can't stand up here in 1 minute and critique an entire book and hundreds of articles that have been about the Beard thesis, as far as that goes. But And he provides, so I've read that book years ago, and he provides all kinds of details about how many stocks and bonds were earned by this person and that person. But what I do know is that the Federalists or the Nationalists who were hell-bent on subverting the Constitution, they were the ones who wanted to use government for their own benefit at the expense of everybody else. And they were the ones who subverted the Constitution. It was Hamilton who invented the idea of implied powers in his debate with Jefferson over the constitutionality of the Bank of the United States. It was Hamilton who first worked out the expansive interpretation of the Commerce Clause that has been used to create unconstitutional government. It was Hamilton who first worked out the expansive interpretation of the General Welfare Clause. And so all of these people who wanted to subvert the Constitution, they're the ones who wanted to use the government as an instrument of plunder. And so it was the old Jeffersonian wing who thought they could possibly stop that. And by the way, the only way that the Jeffersonians thought that the government in the national capital could ever be controlled by the people would be through political organizations organized at the state and local levels of government. They always thought that if the day ever came that if the federal government became the sole arbiter of the limit of its own powers, say through the Supreme Court, then Americans would then live under a tyranny. And that day came after the Civil War. Before the Civil War, you had people like Andrew Jackson telling John Marshall, here you go, John Marshall. That's your opinion. Mine's different. Go play in the traffic. But it was, in one of my books, I quote Woodrow Wilson. He was a political science professor at Princeton before he became president. And in one of his books on Congress, he celebrates the fact that in the post-Civil War era, it was the Supreme Court and only the Supreme Court that had the decision-making power over constitutionality. And so from then on, the people of the states had pretty much, northern states, southern states, eastern states, western states, didn't matter. They pretty much all became appendages of the government of Washington and no longer really had any real effective control over what went on in Washington. You certainly don't today. Jefferson himself thought the country was already too big. It should be maybe broken up into 7 or 8 confederacies, even during his time. And so the idea that the people could have any control whatsoever now is just the most absurd idea in the world. Well, when we had competing currencies, if there were some irresponsible banks who inflated their currencies far beyond what their ability to redeem the currency in gold and silver, it would only be local or a local regional problem. But once you had a national bank, when they inflated, it became a national debacle, your national, and now international. When the Fed has helped create an international depression with the Great Recession of 2008, And sure, people wrote about it. I mean, there were a lot of sound money. If you want one example, who can I refer you to? Condi Roget, I think, is one of the persons. He was from where is he from? I think he was from Massachusetts. And there were look up a book called Democratic Editorials, and Democratic is spelled with CK at the end. And so there were some books that were written in the 19th century like that, that carried on sort of the sound money tradition. But I think his name is spelled Raguet, Condi Raguet. And if you find him, you'll find how these ideas were disseminated. Because the Jeffersonians, their ideas were popularized and by politicians and pundits and journalists until the late 19th century. The 1896 election in America was the last time a real Jeffersonian ran for president. And as I said, Grover Cleveland was probably the last genuine Jeffersonian. One of my articles on lewrockwell.com is called The Last Good Democrat. It's about Grover Cleveland. And there's a new book on Grover Cleveland, by the way, that one of the persons who gave a presentation at the Austrian Scholars Conference in March was the author of this book. So if you do a little searching around on the latest book on Cleveland, if you want to find he wasn't perfect. I mean, he's a politician, so he did some sleazy things, but he did veto something like, 4,000 spending bills or some, more than any other president you ever heard of. And he was a free trader. So he's a pretty good guy, and but he was the last one. And if no other questions, well, one we have time for one more. They were all aristocratic. You know, Hamilton was certainly a super snob and an aristocrat. You know, he married into a wealthy family, the Schuyler family from Philadelphia. He had slaves. You're usually not taught that, but if you read Ron Chernow's book, his wife inherited slaves, and she brought so-called house slaves into the marriage, and so they were all aristocrats. And Jefferson is known for talking about how there's a natural aristocracy in almost every field, every endeavor in life, whatever occupation. There's always a relatively few people who are just better than everybody else at the top. And that's true, isn't it? I mean, as I said in my last lecture, I'm a Baltimore Ravens fan, and they're better than everyone else this year or last year. So whether it's sports or industry, or there's always somebody who's the best at it, at least at some point in time. And so, yeah, he believed in a natural aristocracy, which is just an acknowledgement of reality. But I'm not sure if that's answering your question or what you had in mind. Is that so? Yeah. Yeah, I'm more interested in their ideas on such things as monetary policy and these things rather than what they thought of themselves as aristocrats. Yeah. 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 Okay, yes, I'm sure that's true. Yeah, they all despise democracy, of course. Even Madison said the purpose of the Constitution was to restrain the violence of faction, and the violence of faction is democracy. You know, after all, don't forget, democracy is basically two wolves and a sheep voting on what to have for lunch. That's democracy, and these people understood that. And I think we're out of time. I see 2:30 on the clock back there. Thank you.